You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Friday, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters Friday. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
We've all used Gmail now for what, 10 years? Gmail's been around for 10 years? I don't know how long. But I go back 7 to 10 years in my Gmail, and I'll find somebody who wrote to me who I never responded to. And I'll respond, I'll hit reply, and I'll respond as if they had written to me 1 second ago, and I'll just give a real response. And I find it's a great way to, you know, get back in touch with somebody and maybe have a new kind of fun experience. They remember it. They'll be fascinated that I responded like that. So it's a weird way of building up a connection again with somebody. And so that's one that's memorable, as opposed to, hey, just thinking about you, how are you doing? Like if someone asked me for coffee in 2007, and let's say I never replied, I'll reply back and say, sure, how's next Tuesday at 2 o'clock? And it's amazing how much benefit I've gotten out of that. Like I've gotten so many great interactions have happened after that. Okay, I'm doing a special podcast about what are the best one-minute life hacks. I'm joined here by Steve Cohen, and we have a few other guests who might pop up. But I just want to add first, thanks to WeWork for hosting this podcast. I'm sitting in a WeWork facility. I've never been in one, and this is like an adult Disneyland here. There's a ping pong table. There's a music studio. There's chefs,
free stuff.
There's like
you had me at free stuff.
I feel like everybody is just, are they working or are they just like having fun out here?
And in my mind, I'm listening to this song by REM, Shiny Happy People, because they all seem really happy.
Yeah, I'm like there's like a lot of computers. They do seem like they're working hard, but then other people are having meetings. We're kind of in a glass case doing this podcast, so there's podcast studios here.
Yeah.
So I'm not even trying to...
Fishbowl, I know.
Like, WeWork's not sponsoring this podcast.
No, they
just let us sit here. But
no greater zealot than the recent convert, though. And we're here, and it's...
But here's the interesting thing. I sort of feel everybody calls this the sharing economy, but it's really the access economy. So meaning, like WeWork is not sharing office space. They're not like a charitable organization. You pay, and you have access to office space. But when 20 years ago, my first business, we would get a 10,000 square foot office space and we spent a lot of money. But here you could just join a membership. You could show up at any WeWork and you have access to empty desks and meetings and conference room and podcast studios and kitchens and ping pong tables. And it's like Uber. Uber doesn't share cars. Some people have access to empty seats in their cars that they want to give away and monetize. Some people want access to those excess empty seats. And Uber is really the business is the platform in the middle that allows people who have excess and connects them to people who want access. And they handle all the logistics, the search, the payments, the customer troubles, everything. Airbnb. Some people have excess rooms. Other people want access to those excess rooms. And Airbnb is just, they don't own any of the rooms. Right. They just or the platform in the middle that allows for search, payments, customer service, and all sorts of other things. And so it seems like, and WeWork's the same place.
Yeah.
Some people have access to excess office space. Other people want that, well, willing to pay for that excess office space. And WeWork's the platform in the middle. What I wonder is, when do you actually have to, at some point, we'll never have to buy anything anymore. You'll just kind of use all the things you have access to, like whether it's clothes or chefs or restaurants or office space or cars or whatever.
I was going to say a few things to that. One, I hadn't heard that distinction before between access and share, because I feel like access, share is kind of a euphemism. Like we have Kamal, Biljana, and Jay here. I might want to share my coffee with them, then I'm not going to charge them. But if they want access to my coffee, they're going to have to pay, you know?
So no, I think, but there are companies, like, speaking of food and beverages, there are companies, and it's a little bit harder, but let's say, or there, where there's like Seamless or Grubhub, where there's all these restaurants with excess food.
Yes, yes.
And there's, or excess capacity to make food. There's people like me who want to sit at home and not go out to eat. And then Grubhub is the platform in the middle that allows me to search, allows me to order from the best chefs around. And then they handle all the customer payments, the transactions, the logistics of delivery, customer service again. And again, it's not like I ever have to cook. I can just get access to the best meals made by the best chefs.
Well, the other thing I was going to say, being at WeWork, that I remember when it was really starting to explode and it keeps doing a lot better. We're told, like, we're in one of 50 in New York City, that I thought was instructive, was they took what other people might have looked at as a real estate company and they made it seem like a lifestyle. And it was just before the podcast, you were talking about why you invest in stuff, because how it makes you feel or the perceived value. And that's similar to here. You have a good feeling about being here. It's not just a kind of pedestrian office space. It's a cool environment. It's inspiring.
By the way, that's not why I invest in something. This might be why I buy something.
Oh, interesting.
So investing is a completely different thing.
Yeah, no, you and Kamal forgot more than I know.
Let's not confuse the two.
I speak humbly.
So, yes. So here, before we get into the best woman life hacks, here's the idea that just came to me. Considering that we live in this access economy and more things we're just going to have easier access to, as opposed to a need to buy. It used to be, in order to live in a house, you had to buy a house. Then you could rent. Then you could Airbnb. Same thing with cars. If you wanted an SUV, you had to buy it. Then you could rent it. Then you could, now I can just get an SUV anytime I want. I don't have to spend $100,000 to get an SUV. I can just drive one all over the city using Uber for $20. But here's the idea of the day. Let's create, or any of the listeners can create, because I'm not going to do it, create access in a box, access economy in a box. So it's off, it's software that you could just, you know, get on the web, or it could be in the cloud or whatever, and you can just fill in, the software is basically the platform in the middle, which handles search, posting, payment, logistics, customer service. And the person who has the access economy in a box software can put in whatever category it is, like babysitters. Babysitters and parents. So now I'm a parent. The software would specify I'm going to upload the age of my kid, any issues, where I live. Then it'll show me all the potential babysitters in the area who are available. A babysitter, this is just an example of a use. I don't know if this is a good use or not. It could be nurse, you create babysitter in a box, you create nurses in a box, you could create whatever. But access economy in a box, you kind of generalize the basic things in the Uber platform, the Airbnb platform, the WeWork platform, the Grubhub platform, and all these things are multi-billion dollar companies. Like Uber's gonna go public for $120 billion. Well, Kamal, what do you think of this idea, access economy in a box?
The software layer, you mean?
Yeah. Creating that platform that's basically, it's the same platform for every one of these companies.
People have tried it.
They have?
People tried it with apps. It didn't go anywhere. Because you still need that on the other side, people have to be passionate enough to like do it, to build that. So rather than the software layer, just go, it's not that hard to build step by step one of these. Just go off and do that.
But I'm saying, I don't know which business will work, like nurses and, the Uber of nurses, the Uber of babysitters, the Uber of chefs. But I'm saying I want to create the platform in the middle so that anyone else can create their Uber of X company to kind of generalize it. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. I would just say people like, you know, if you're a nurse and you want to build an Uber of X, build an Uber for nurses. You know that space. If you're a Y, build an Uber for Y, the space that you know that you have an unfair advantage on. So the software layer is like, how you'll make money on that with the SaaS business. You have to have some things really take off for that thing to make money.
Or maybe you have to partner with somebody who has an instant use for it. Like,
yeah. Like someone who's got that idea, who's got the network, who's got like the people there, but they don't know how to build the software part. You build it for them, but use that.
And then you generalize it.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
All right, on to... That was the idea of the day. Not all ideas are good, but it's worth having an idea, yeah. Right? It's worth considering an idea.
I wish I had my waiter's pad to write that down.
Like, we just identified a multi-billion dollar yeah. potential industry, and it's not unreasonable to come up with like one idea or a couple ideas to make it easier. Okay, best one-minute life hacks. The first one, Steve, you just mentioned, waiter's pads. This is such a great life hack for me. I've written about it before, but I want to describe why I always carry around waiter's pads. I even have one in my pocket right now. So,
says, for those of you who can't see, he pulled a waiter's pad out of his pocket.
It says guest check on it. It has date, table, guest, server, and then you can have, and then it has about 15 lines where you can put things. So the reason this is such a great hack for a lot of reasons. One is, it's a great place for me to put my 10 ideas a day because you can't really write a lot. You can only write bullet points. So it forces you to go from idea to idea and not spend too much time on any one idea. It makes you quickly write down the most important things and not write an entire novel. But there's a couple ideas in this that makes it a hack. And by the way, I hate the word life hacks because I feel like it's overused. So I'll just... I don't know what a better word is, though. That's why what's a better word than life hack?
Just go with it for now.
Yeah. So here's what happens in a meeting. And here's why I like using this. Let's say I'm in a meeting with like, you know, five people and it's a board meeting or it's an investor meeting or whatever. Everyone pulls out their Moleskine, their expensive notebooks that's like $80, and they all start, they get their expensive fountain pens and dip it in ink and start writing. And I just pull out my waiter's pad and throw it right on the table. And 100% of the time, someone will say, I don't know why they all think it's an original joke, but they all say, this has happened 100 meetings in a row. Someone will say, I'll take fries with that burger. Like that's the joke everyone uses. And
what was that percentage of times?
100% of the time.
Okay.
And, you know, and then, you know, so we'll joke about that. And then people will say, why do you have a waiter's pad? And I'll say the thing about the bullet points, but also I'll say it cost me 10 cents a pad and I want to be frugal. So A, I've just become center of the conversation at this important meeting. B, I demonstrate in a real way without bragging that I'm frugal, I demonstrate how frugal I am. And it's also quirky. So you stand out in a meeting. You always want to be the person who's a little outside of the comfort zone, the place least crowded. So, and I will also say in a restaurant, if I sit down in a restaurant and I just put the waiter's pad down next to me, the way other people put phones down next to them, the waiters always treat me better.
Well, and I'll say to your credit, like these aren't just things for you to be perceived as eccentric. You do this a lot. Like you actually had a lot of $2 bills or other of your eccentricities that have worked for you, right? So I guess people listening out there find stuff that works for you, but I could see why that would work for you. Like I would always have a spiral notebook and I kind of have my own systems where I like in red I might put like a personal a guest we want to have on the show so it stands out so I can look back and do it, or green I might say you need to sleep more, you know, like personal stuff. Blue, I might say, I just have a code, like kind of like USA Today, green is money, red is sports. I don't know who reads USA Today other than people in hotels, but like I used to read it. Purple is life, red is sports, and blue is life, you know. So I think, yeah, I think we've talked about this before, where Scott Adams always says, like, you want to have a goal and a system. And if you have a system, maybe it helps you reach your goals.
Well, and here's the thing about the system is that, you know, I can't write a diary in a waiter's bed. Really, this is so I can write 10 ideas and I try to fit them on one page. So I'm not, it forces me to not write too much. It forces me to be very concise in my thinking. Or if I'm having a podcast guest and I'm writing all the things I'm learning, it just forces me to be very concise because I can't fill out page after page after page. It's just a waiter's pad. It's small. And it fits in my pocket.
Yeah. No, I definitely feel like whatever system one wants to use, it has to work for you. And another thing I like about that, and, you know, they're cheap enough for you to lend me some. If they're only 10 cents a waiter's pad, you should give me like 5 or 10 and I'll borrow them.
All right.
Well, I want access to your waiter's pads.
By the way, I saw... I say the first time I bought waiter's pads, it cost. I went to the Bowery and it cost me 10. I bought 100 pads for $10, but now I own a bar, so I get the waiter's pads for free.
Like I like to say, if it's free, I'll take three. You know, but what I was going to say about that is, I was listening to Jason Calacanis talk about when he's in meetings, he eschews the idea of having a phone over there because, you know, if you have a pad, people know you're not looking at your phone. Even if I a lot of times use the notes aspect of my phone. And, you know, I think there's something to be said about, hey, if you're taking notes, they know you're kind of serious and you're focused on them and you're present, right? Like, it's not like you're writing your grocery list on there.
They could see, like, I feel like with the more expensive notebooks, they can't necessarily see what you're doing. With the waiter's pad, they could see I'm clearly not doodling, I'm taking notes. By the way, there's some research about the phone. If you're at a lunch and your phone is out, even if it's face down, the person will pay, like, I don't know how they research this, but the person will basically pay 20% less attention to you that you're having lunch with if your phone is out, even with its face down. So it's just some...
I only caught 80% of what you just said.
All right, the next hack. This was told to me by an ex... he wouldn't tell me if he was ex-CIA or ex-DIA, which is the Defense Intelligence Agency, but he was a member of some intelligence agency. I met him on a plane. He's actually been on this podcast, but I won't... Oh, actually, I could say what his name was. R.P. Eddy, who was on this podcast. And it's a lie detection hack. And he used to be an interrogator for the Defense Department on some very high-profile cases. That I can't mention which cases because... I don't know. I don't know if he told me in confidence, but he definitely, it was on a red eye from California and he was, you know, drinking a little bit. And so he's telling me these high profile cases. The hack is if you ask someone a question and they don't, they answer it, but not with the direct answer. So, if you say, I always think in terms of relationships, but if you say, you know, hi, honey, where'd you go last night? And she responds, oh, I went out with friends. Notice she didn't answer the question. So I'm not saying she's lying, but there's more to the story, usually, which, you know, may or may not be true. That was just his point of doing this for like 20 years. You know, and that's how with defense and when he's interrogating like potential spies, he always listens for if they're actually answering the question or slightly changing, you know, the answer to fit a different question. So I don't know if that resonates or makes sense.
I definitely think so. No, I think it's instructive, just what you said. Like, if they're not answering the question or they deflect, you know, I think as you spend more and more time with somebody, you'll know if they're habitually evasive or, you know, passive about stuff.
And they might be evasive at different levels in different ways. So you have to observe that. So that's related to his next lie detection hack that he told me, which is he would always give the person he was interrogating a rolling chair and he would ask some basic questions. Like, this is almost like a lie detector test, what a lie detector test is. He would ask basic questions that he would know are truthful, like, hey, where do you live? How old are you? You know, what's your job title? And then he would ask harder and harder questions. And if they start to roll away with the chair or use the rolling aspect of the chair a little more, he would know that they're starting to lie.
And I think, you know, I thought about that and I think it's instructive on a number of levels. Like, if you're people always say like say the truth, it's easier. You won't have to remember what you said, or you'll always remember what you said. And if you're not telling the truth, it stands to reason that you're thinking of some other believable story that would suffice. So that's why there's that pause too. Like if you're in a chair, you're moving back so that you have more time to kind of construct an alternate story.
You ever see the movie Now You See Me with Jesse Eisenberg?
I'm familiar with the film, but I have not seen it.
Have you seen it, Kamal?
Jim Carrey and
Woody Harrelson.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So Woody Harrelson plays this kind of mentalist and there's one scene where he's trying to figure out the name of somebody that someone's having an affair with. And so he just very quickly says, you know, A, B, C, D, E. And then he's looking at the person's face for a slight change in expression. And he gets to J. And he's like, J, you know, Janice, Janelle, you know. And he figures out the person's name because he sees twitches.
Yeah.
So I decided to try this technique. So my girlfriend said, I bought popcorn, but I hid it from you. And so I did this exact same thing. I said really quickly, like every, you know, cabinet and drawer. And she did actually twitch when I mentioned a certain cabinet. And that was the cabinet where she had the popcorn hidden. So it does sort of work if you know a person's kind of language of expressions and twitches. Now, if someone who's a professional mentalist probably knows it very well, so you could do it with anyone. But that technique does seem to work.
Just look for, like, tells.
Yeah.
Well, you play a lot of poker, right? I'm sure some of that works with poker, too.
Yeah, though tells are very valuable in poker. Particularly, tells are the main way in poker you make money if you're really good playing someone really bad. If you're both really good, tells could be insidious because a very good player will fake a tell. So you have to determine if someone's faking a tell or faking a tell. But if you're just playing someone, like I remember one time I was playing at a poker club. This is exactly 20 years ago. Norm Macdonald, the comedian, shows up. He was much younger, Norm Macdonald. And everybody wanted to sit right next to him because whoever sits to the left of the worst player at the table wins the most money because the person bets, you raise, and then everyone else goes out and it's just you versus that person. But Norm Macdonald had so many tells. Everyone was, and he would just go back for more and more money. Everybody wanted to sit next to him.
Anyway. Ideally, you want somebody who's really bad and who has a lot of money.
Exactly. That's exactly true. And that works for
the best combination.
That works for poker and other gambling games like backgammon. Networking hack. This was told to me by a different ex. Again, nobody admits that they're CIA, but this person was special forces and some intelligence agency. So he basically told me, even if you don't smoke, always carry around a pack of cigarettes. And he said, for instance, let's say someone you want to network with is at a restaurant and takes a smoking break. Even if you're at another table, you could now take a smoking break with them and start talking to them. And you could follow them outside and start a conversation. The other thing is, let's say you leave your cigarettes behind right before someone you want to network with is sitting down at a restaurant, a club, a meeting. You can step outside, then you can go back and say, "Ugh, I left my cigarettes here," and that gives you a chance to start talking. So I thought that was an interesting networking hack.
Yep.
Unobvious. No one would suspect you of doing these things on purpose.
Yeah, like when I was in news or TV, you would forget something somewhere, so you can go in and eavesdrop on somebody or, you know, and I think
you would do
like,
that.
Hey, I'm sorry, what did I forgot you ever, it. Don't mean to linger around, but...
What did you ever hear?
No, you could hear all kinds of things. I mean, if you were at a particular place and you see people huddling over there and then they look at you as if you're, you know, an interloper and you're like, sorry, I just forgot my, you know, my book over there. You know, don't mean to eavesdrop, but we're meaning to eavesdrop. I'm just saying. You know, but
do you ever see that Seinfeld, George Costanza actually leaves a tape recorder and a briefcase behind at a meeting? So he tried it in a very, you know, kind of the thing we always think about. Like, what if I just left? I always wonder, like, I used to have an office on 19th Street with my first business. And I always used to think I should just wire up the elevator, because somebody meets you, they get on the elevator, and obviously they're gonna talk about the meeting. I thought that would be a great way to discover how to get clients better. Like, you know, of course it would be illegal, and I'm not sure if it's illegal, it would be unethical. We never did it. I should have done it, because it probably would have made more money for the business. But after a meeting now, because I used to think that way, after a meeting, I never talk in the elevator, because I think somebody, if I was thinking that, I'm thinking someone else who's thinking it, who would do it, actually did it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Do you know anyone who's done that? It seems like such an obvious way to make more money if you have a business and if millions of dollars are at stake.
Just for those of you out there, so you're talking about like recording the elevator, like afterwards?
Yeah.
So you could see what's going on. Yeah, I mean, I don't know anybody who's done it, you know.
And if they did, I don't think they'd talk about it. You know, the cigarettes thing? I know someone who's actually gotten out of like really hairy situations in like middle of Africa or Middle East or with police and military by just offering them cigarettes.
Yeah, because cigarettes are currency in a lot of situations.
No, but she was like, it humanizes you. It's like, you know, if they're like being rough and like how third world militaries are, third world police is, and you're just sharing a cigarette with them. All of a sudden, you're no longer just, you know, some suspect. You're a human being offering them a cigarette. Yeah, literally got her out of some pretty hairy stuff.
And they always tell people who are about to go to jail, make sure you have a good access to lots of cigarettes.
Yeah, thankfully none of us are going to jail anytime soon. But I personally carry a lot of gum. You know, I like gum. I like different flavors, and that could serve a similar purpose. Now, people don't habitually go outside and have a gum break. But, like, it's nice to give a piece of gum to people, you know, when you see them. I mean, no, there are different ways you could offer. If you're in Canada, you could have marijuana.
So this is this next hack, and we're kind of just churning through these. If anyone has any questions, post them on Twitter and we'll describe more. But this next one is... I call it an interview or speaking hack. So not an interview like a podcast interview, but like if you're doing a job interview or if you're doing public speaking. So if you're doing a job interview, you say something like, I'm sure all the others you've interviewed before me were great, and then you start your interview. Or if you're doing public speaking, you know, let's give a hand for all the others who came before me. You know, everyone gives a hand. And this is actually a cognitive bias. It's called choice ambiguity bias. And if you kind of lump in a whole group of people as some mysterious other, then the brain of the person you're talking to has a hard time all of a sudden remembering who they spoke to, because they're now in this big group called the other. And it's a very powerful technique to make your talk stand out or your interview stand out. And I've used this very effectively and it works. You know, I don't know why it works. It just creates kind of an out group. And then the in group is you and the audience, or you and the person you're interviewing with. You know, now they treat you in a different way than this. Everybody else feels ambiguous now once you do that.
I think that's a great thing. And unless you're the first speaker, you know.
Well, maybe then you can say, give a hand for, I've thought about this. I always try to be the last speaker at a conference, sure, so I can say this, but if you're the first speaker, you could find other ways to do it. Like, you know, I'm sure everyone coming ahead of me is going to say this. That's not such a bad thing for them to say, but I just want to say these things. So again, you throw them in a group with a very generic thing that they can say.
I remember there was Howard Bragman wrote a book about PR, and he was a very successful public relations person. And he said, I have these clients who said, like, I just feel I'm a blonde, interchangeable anchor and, you know, this attractive blonde. And he said, that's the worst thing you really want to do is be interchangeable. You want to be unique in your own way. So by emphasizing that these other people are others, you know, then you're distinguishing yourself right away.
I don't quite understand why it's a cognitive bias. Like other cognitive biases, like confirmation bias, I could understand. So confirmation bias is, I believe in some political issue. And then your brain just starts to look for examples of where you're right because it's invested time into thinking you're right. So it wants to find more ways to prove you're right. So I understand how that cognitive bias works. I really don't understand why this bias works, but it does.
Well, it's kind of like the rapper Ice Cube. Not that there's a Dr. Ice Cube or a dentist Ice Cube or accountant, but
the,
where
the rapper,
he exactly
rapper, comma the, Ice
of
Cube
all the, of all the Ice Cubes out there, this one's a rapper, and he said, "There's a lot of you and one of me," you know, and that's essentially what you're saying, right?
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
A lot of you other speakers out there. There's one James Altucher with his waiter's bed and $2 bills.
Oh, and so I even mentioned actually in this in the notes to this. This is related to recency bias, where you try to be the last person interviewed or the last person to speak on the agenda because people in any situation remember two things. They remember the peak moment of emotional intensity. So if someone goes on stage and says something completely outrageous, you'll remember that. But they also remember, so that's, there's some other bias there, but they also always remember the most recent. And so that helps as well. So I don't know how you can always arrange that, but if you combine that with this choice ambiguity bias, then, by the way I found out about this is I was speaking at an event and I was very nervous and I asked a professor of behavioral psychology, what should I do? And he's the one who told me about these biases and see if you can be the last. And I remember I was the second to last. The last person to speak at this conference was Tim Ferriss. And so the way I approached it was when I went up on the stage, I said, well, I am the last speaker before Tim Ferriss. Give it up to all the other pre-Tim Ferriss speakers. And now I'm standing out using this bias. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I was just talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Friday, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters Friday. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This one's a writing hack that I'm curious if you guys use, but I almost always use it. I use it like 90% of the time. Even being aware of this hack while I'm writing doesn't matter. I still use this hack and it makes my writing better. So the hack is you write something and whatever it is you wrote, remove the first paragraph and the last paragraph and it'll be your writing will have more impact. And so it's interesting, even being aware of that while I'm writing the first paragraph and the last paragraph doesn't matter. Still removing the first and the last paragraphs tend to make the writing better. And I think it's because when you're writing the first paragraph, you don't really know yet how the piece is going to shape up. So you're a little more nervous writing it. And so it's not as strong. And the last one, you're trying to kind of find some nifty, almost artificial way of having a conclusion. But if you remove the first and the last, it's like it reads now as if you dove right into the story, right into the most emotional parts of the story. And if you conclude without the last paragraph, there's no more nifty summary and conclusion. There's just this end. And that's usually more beautiful and poetic somehow. And it's more kind of a more real conclusion. I don't know if you've noticed that, Kamal, in your writing.
You're absolutely right. Especially that ending part, because ending you're trying, because especially when you've written something
and
good.
And beginnings you're trying. Like often people are stuck at the beginning. They get writer's block at the beginning and they're trying too hard at the ending.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I've found also sometimes? I'll move them. I'll see that they actually go somewhere else in the piece if they're really good. But especially the ending. That ending part, yeah.
And I always try, like I'll write anything and just even to see, I'll just cut out the first and the last and then read it over, and almost every single time it's better, even though I'm aware of this hack.
Yeah, 9 times out of 10 I'd say that work.
And you are very economical with your writing, right?
Like, yeah.
I've heard both of you talk about how some people pad their writing with a lot of extraneous verbiage that, and again, it seems ironic coming from me talking about extraneous verbiage, but that they don't really need, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes from actually, I don't know what it is, insecurity, or you feel like you have to over-explain or whatever, but, you know, economy of words is the, I think, is the purest form of writing.
Yeah, I mean, another writing hack that I do, which I've never really, maybe I've written about it once, but I this one I call a hack because it's almost like a trick to easily make your writing. It almost, I think of hacks as things that require no work but make your life a little better. This next thing requires a little bit of work, but whenever I write a first draft of something, I try to make the second draft 30% less, 30% fewer words. And that tends to work for me as well. Like, I really try hard to scrub out 30% of the words.
Yeah, the second draft should be a lot leaner than the first draft. First draft, you're just basically vomiting over the page.
Yeah, and sometimes there's a temptation, oh, I forgot to write this, I forgot to write that. But then I try to, again, make at least the final draft 30% less than the first draft. And that tends to work really well. 'Cause people get bored now if they read for too long.
Yeah, Love Yourself was like 90% less than what the original drafts were.
Well, your book, Love Yourself, taught me a lot about book writing in general in today's world. We've always been told by mainstream publishers, hey, don't submit a book until it's 65,000 words. But in the day and age where bookstores are disappearing, publishers can't even get books into bookstores anymore. I mean, bookstores are much more selective. And, you know, Amazon with CreateSpace and Kindle and so on, it's much easier to self-publish. The definition of a book is no longer 65,000 words. Love Yourself, I think, was 8,000 words.
Correct.
And it was a best-selling book. And it's nobody says, oh, that was just a long article. It's a book. And people view it as a book. Like, the definition of a book has changed, and you taught me that. And I still wish I could follow that advice and write an 8,000-word book, because then I'd write like a book every other day or so. Probably a boring book, but it's interesting.
I just think sometimes, you know, in the podcast, we get a lot of authors, and some I'm less impressed with than others, because I think, as the old Mark Twain adage said, this letter would be shorter if I had more time. And I think some authors make you do a lot of work that they should be doing the work. You know, it takes work to economize and to get rid of stuff that you don't need there. And so I think you do, both of you, you're very economical when you write, and every word matters, and I think that's the way it should be.
Well, you know, there's a Facebook group called Writers and Rant, or Write and Rant, which, I don't know, are you a member of that Facebook group?
Does it sound like one I would want to join?
But you were funny, because Tucker Max just mentioned you in a comment this morning on that group. But somebody asked the question, how many words should a business book be? And there was like 100 responses. You know, people were saying 60,000 words, 65,000 words. Ryan Holiday, of course, being one of the smartest people around, said, you know, write how many words you need. and no more, no less. And Tucker said different, write as few words as possible, and used your book as an example. And I responded, don't write a business book.
Yeah, you know, that's probably the best advice.
Because I'm just sick of, like, every business book, they're just using it to get speaking gigs and consulting gigs. I don't need another book like, oh, how to be a leader, how to have great habits, how to, you know. Now, in some cases, it's not a business book. Like, I appreciate Jocko Willink's The Dichotomy of Leadership, you know, and so on. He's coming at it from a very different point of view. But just somebody who studies academic research and then spits it out into a highly
voluminous
book.
Detail too. That's what kills me, where it's every single thing you ever wanted to know about that, and they're trying to prove their scholarship. And I don't get a lot out of it. I don't remember a lot.
Which
out
is
of
why
it.
We avoid, yeah. We avoid writers as opposed to the people who are experiencers. Not just people who are, you know, spitting out academic research. Now, there's a couple of counterexamples, like, you know, Yuval Harari wrote Sapiens, obviously did research on the history of the human species, and wrote a fascinating book. So I think the best books like that are highly curated examples of lots of research, but not just spitting out scientific studies and just so they can get consulting gigs. And that's like the main style of book in the business book section.
You know, I had someone recently DM me on Twitter, and she said she just finished the first draft of a book, and she, you know, she had actually listened to an interview with you and I, where I said that Rebirth, I wrote at least 8 drafts, and she's like, I can't even imagine doing it. So she said, how many drafts do I need to do before it's ready to go? And, you know, I was thinking about it because there's no specific answer. Right. I'm like, so here's the answer. You have to know who you're writing for. If you're writing for yourself, vomit all over the page and publish. Done. It's out of your system. Done. But if you're writing for a reader, then you just got to go at it and hammer and chisel until it's the best you could have put out there. Then you put it out there.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to know who you're writing for.
And I think 8 drafts, and again, there's no specific number that's the answer. I mean, what is it? Old Man and the Sea might have had 100 drafts. Who knows? But I think 8 drafts is probably about average, you know, for a good book. And first draft is probably about average for a bad book.
First 3 drafts are...
And advice Stephen Dubner once gave me, which he got from the a book by William Zinsser, who writes a lot about how to be a great nonfiction writer. But Stephen Dubner, who co-wrote Freakonomics, he suggested to me, and what he told me what he does, which is after each draft, he reads the entire thing out loud, and whatever makes him feel cringeworthy, he knows he should take out. And so that's a good technique.
Yeah, that's one of the techniques I use. I read out loud, but that's a later draft. Then I also do another one where I print out, and then I read it. It reads different on paper than it does on screen. And every a different medium, it reads differently. And but ultimately the ear knows that last, before you hit the final draft, that last draft, you have to hear it to your ear. And every time you stumble when you're reading, you got to fix something there.
You just gave me an idea, which I use in other areas of my life, but maybe I should also use it for writing. Not only should you read it, but maybe you should take a video of yourself reading it and then watch that video.
Wow.
Because when you're reading it, you're hearing something differently than when you watch yourself reading it. So Steve had recently arranged for me to audition for a serious play. And they had, the producer was there. They had serious cast members who were the readers for me. So I read, I had to memorize lines, and I auditioned. And Jay, our audio engineer here, took the video. I came out of that audition thinking, man, I'm an actor. Like, I did such a great job. I'm surprised they didn't put me on the main stage immediately. And then Jay sent me the video, and I'm like, man, I sucked. Like, I could really see how I was different from the professionals who I was reading to. And I've greatly improved my stand-up comedy because Jay videotapes my stand-up. Just watching myself doing stand-up, I'll even watch myself on mute to see how my body's moving while I'm doing stand-up. It's such a drastic improvement. I'm going to try it with writing, reading out loud, videotaping myself, reading and watching that. So that's a great idea. And
well, Kamala always says, what you measure improves, right? And that's just another way of measuring it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a different way of measuring it. I think that's a good hack too, is whatever you want to improve, figure out a way to measure it. That's not quite a hack. That's a technique.
Yeah. And make the measurement available in front of you on a daily basis. You can see the pattern. I mean, we just normally, like human beings, will want to step up. You know, put your weight every day, like on your bathroom mirror. Like, you know, just like once you start seeing the trend, you'll want it to get better.
Yeah, and it's a skill to come up with the right metric. Like, you know, losing weight, you is an easy metric because you see pounds, but maybe you're eating less calories, but maybe it's all donuts instead of vegetables. So you have to figure out kind of the right metric, which is a challenge. And writing, it's not necessarily, you know, the number of, you know, we've been talking about various metrics, like watch yourself, make sure nothing's cringeworthy. Other people use Amazon sales ranks, which is not a bad metric, but it might not be perfect either. So you always want to think about what the right metric is. Two more hacks, and I think this is going to end up to be, there's going to be a part two, but this one I call the email hack. I've written about this before, but I do this, I don't do this every day, but I probably do this a couple times a week. I did this yesterday, actually. Find go we've all used Gmail now for what, 10 years? Gmail's been around for 10 years. I don't know how long. But I go back 7 to 10 years in my Gmail, and I'll find somebody who wrote to me who I never responded to, and I'll respond, I'll hit reply, and I'll respond as if they had written to me 1 second ago, and I'll just give a real response as if they had written to me a second ago. And I find it's a great way to, you know, get back in touch with somebody and maybe have a new kind of fun experience. They remember it. They'll be fascinated that I responded like that. So it's a weird way of building up a connection again with somebody. And so that's one that's memorable, as opposed to, hey, just thinking about you, how are you doing? Like if someone asked me for coffee in 2007, I'll reply back and say, let's say I never replied. I'll reply back and say, sure, how's next Tuesday at 2 o'clock? And yeah, it's amazing how much benefit I've gotten out of that. Like I've gotten so many great interactions have happened after that. Yesterday, I'm trying to think how I can describe the example. It was someone who actually hadn't gotten in touch, who wrote me 2 years ago. I hadn't replied. And she was asking for a favor for her brother. And I replied, sure, send over his resume. And she was like, whoa. And we just started talking, and she ended up giving me advice about something that was very useful. And it magnifies the intensity of the interaction when you do it that way, and people respond accordingly because it's so because of that heightened intensity. So I find that hack really works, and it's fun, and it's funny.
Yeah. I was going to say, you wouldn't have your website without that
hack. All right. So the first time I did this was, it was like 2009 or 2010. In 2003, a reader of mine wrote me. He knew it was my birthday. He wrote me and said, hey, I bought you a birthday gift. I bought jamesaltucher.com. And I thought to myself, oh, I'm never going to write my own blog on jamesaltucher.com. I don't need it. So I never responded to him. And so in 2009, I hit reply on that one. And I said, okay, that's great. Thank you so much. I'll take it. And so it was like a 6-year difference. And he wrote back and he's like, whoa, no one ever took that long to respond to me. But here's the thing, I'll tell you, he became a good friend, and A, he still had he kept paying for it, he had my website still. Wow. So I now have jamesaltucher.com as a result. And that was in 2009. He wrote me yesterday. Wow. Because he wanted to pitch an idea for a podcast. He had a friend who bought a domain name for practically nothing and then just sold it last week for $1 million, and he wanted to maybe describe the story on the podcast. So it was one I was going to forward to you.
Yeah, I think it's great. Yeah, and I'll respond to you 5 years from now and say, yeah, let's do it.
So
I was going to give you a couple of email hacks that I learned. I just think on the subject line sometimes when people read it, like I remember when I left CBS after 10 years, I didn't say moving on, or, you know, I just said thank you. You know, and people are more inclined to read some if you say thank you and you're grateful rather than self-absorbed and, hey, moving on to greener pastures, you know, too bad, so sad. You know, there's a way, I think, so when I'm dealing with people, I'm mindful of the words you use.
Like, oh my God, that's such a great hack. Like, because yeah, you always see people moving on and saying, hey, I've had such a great time here. I've decided to make a change. In my, you know, it's all about them.
Yeah, yeah.
And instead of saying the thank you.
Like Madonna's tribute to Aretha Franklin.
Like,
sorry, Madonna.
Even when you're writing like an autobiography, you should still have the agenda of the readers in mind, even though it's a book about you.
Yeah.
Like I think when you wrote Love Yourself, or when I wrote Choose Yourself, or when we do these podcasts, it's always with the listener or the reader in mind, even though you're writing about yourself or doing a podcast with a guest. And so on. So that's a great addition to my hack, is to make sure their agenda.
There's that, and I'm always just careful about the words you use. And again, I'm always very mindful of not, you know, handling people or manipulating people. I just think it makes me better in how I do things. If somebody's running late, I try not to say no problem. I'll say sure, great, can't wait to see you. You know, it's just how we use our language, and I think it's important. You know.
So, I almost wish we could dive into more of these, but now we've been going for 40 minutes and I have to wrap up soon. But we'll do a part two. And the last one I want to do is the 1 second happiness hack. And because it's hard to be happy, so it's hard to make this a hack. But someone told me an equation once. They made it like a mathematical equation. Happiness equals reality over expectations. So, and the example my friend told me was like, imagine you're trying to lose weight. So your weight might be, I don't know, 200 and you would like to be 150. I'm making up numbers. So the reality is 200 pounds, and the reality can only change slowly, but you want to be 150 and you think you're going to be happy at 150. So that's your, so you're not going to be, because reality changes slowly, and your expectations is 150, it's going to be a long time before your happiness is 100%. Yeah. So right now at 200 over 150, or maybe I'm reversing it. Am I reversing it? Maybe I'm reversing it. Maybe it's expectations.
Another way
reality
to look at it is, I've heard people talk about how your unhappiness equals like your expectation minus reality.
Yeah. So
if
saying,
expectations have millions of dollars and you're making $5 an hour, you know, then you're that unhappy.
Right. So if your expectations go down, if you say, oh, I could be happy at 200 pounds, you could change that in a second. And instead of having to wait until you're 150, where you still might not be happy anyway, yeah. Happiness becomes all about expectations, because reality is slow to move, but expectations you can change in a second. Like you could say, oh, if I was married, I'd be happy. But if you learn how to be happy where you are right now, or if your expectations are, look, I could be happy going to a movie tonight, yeah, then suddenly your expectations change, you're happy, and being happy might actually help you meet the person,
absolutely,
in your life, or lose the weight or whatever. So I always think of, whenever I think, oh, I'm unhappy, I always think of what expectation is not being, where are my reality and my expectations differing, and how can I change my expectations? Because you always can, right? It's all relative. Like, you're not in solitary confinement in jail for the rest of your life. Like, expectations can always change.
Well, another way that I look at it that's helped me quite a bit is just to really just focus on, you know, your process rather than the outcome, and just to be very process oriented.
Yes.
And I think if one can do that, then they're a lot better off, you know, and just in the case of weight loss, to say, okay, I'll feel good about myself if I could only eat 2,000 calories rather than if I have some external goal.
Well,
I'll feel good about myself if I try these five new things.
And Steve, how many podcast guests have we had where, I mean, process...
37, just kidding. I don't know.
Process is greater than outcomes for almost every single one of our podcast
guests.
Yes,
absolutely.
Like, take an author. Take, like, your friend Brad Meltzer, who's been on the podcast.
Yeah.
The outcome that an author wants is they want their book to be published and then to be a bestseller and then more books and then maybe a movie and whatever. Brad Meltzer got rejected. He submitted his book to whatever it was, 21 publishers, and he got rejected 23 times. So
yeah,
twice by two publishers who didn't know. And if his happiness depended on the outcomes, he would have been a very miserable man all the time. But he focused on being a better and better writer, writing more books, and eventually he got books accepted. Now he's selling millions of copies of books and writing. He's living the dream life. He's writing whatever he wants. And
has a new TV show on PBS. We're happy for you,
Brad. Writes comic books.
Yeah, comic books coming on the podcast. I want to say January 6th or January 7th. Got a new thriller.
But we see this with everybody. If like, I had a friend of mine recently. Her TV show got not accepted. And instead of saying, okay, I'm going to work on process, like, A, I'm going to become a better writer, work on making a better TV show. B, I'm going to maybe look for other studios and other production companies. She got so depressed and felt so sorry for herself. And we learned from Amy Morin, who wrote 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. The first thing a mentally strong person doesn't do is feel sorry for yourself. And maybe you could feel sorry for yourself for 10 minutes, but don't spend a week feeling sorry for yourself because an outcome you had no control over. Like, you never know why someone rejects you. They could have had a bad day. They could be about to get fired. There could be some other agenda. If you always focus on the process, you're going to succeed. This is a marathon and not a sprint. Like, I lost all my money in 2002 or 2001, but I focused on how can I be a better investor? How can I be a better writer? How can I find more options in my life for success? If I had just depended on the outcome, I would have killed myself.
Speaking of killing yourself, Kamal.
Wow, with that lead in. You know, there's interesting segue, right? Like, there's like the Buddha thing, you know, where people say, he said that life is suffering. I think there's a misunderstanding there. The nature of the mind is dissatisfaction. So even if you say, I'm going to be happy, let's say we say, I'm going to be happy when I lose 50 pounds, and you get there, you'll only be happy for a certain amount of time, and then you just fall back to your set state.
Right.
So what we got to work on is our set state, you know, like, with the process that Steve talks about, what process gives you is fulfillment. Like the act of writing itself, act of writing a great sentence or making progress in my book is so fulfilling. Like, publishing doesn't even meet that level of fulfillment.
Right. And the other thing to remember is when you start writing or you start anything that's worth doing, you're going to suck in the beginning. So like, I see this more in kids, but like, they'll play a game of tennis and they'll lose the very first time, or they'll play golf and lose the first time, and they say, oh, I suck, I should never do this again. Because they focused, kids have a tendency to focus immediately on outcome, because you take a test, you either get an A or an F, and if you get an F, you give up. But process, if you enjoy the process, you're okay with sucking for a while as you learn, because you see you get pleasure out of the improvement. And then if you just persist, and it's the whole thing, if you try to become 1% better a day, even though that doesn't really mean anything, like, how do you become a 1% better writer? It's hard to quantify, but if you think in that way and you focus on process, that compounds and you become 3,800% better in a year, and you'll see the difference, and everyone else around you will see the difference.
I agree. Like I like to say, little by little, the little becomes a lot, and I think it's made me a lot happier just focusing on the process and just getting better and better. I know we're trying to wrap up. I know I'm like that kid in school who raises his hand and says, didn't you forget to give us homework? But I wanted you to talk about, you know, the day you first alighted upon the waiter's pad and how that changed your life, because you had been going through a very bad time.
Yeah.
And you all of a sudden, did that spur you to becoming an idea machine, or you, like?
Yeah. So what happened was it was the perfect storm. And again, everybody, you know, depression and unhappiness are relative. People have had it a lot worse than me, but I had made a company, sold a company. People know this story. I lost every single dime. I was losing my house. I couldn't sell the house because I lived right next to Ground Zero. So, like, the FBI still had quarantined the area, and the smell from 9/11 was there for a good year afterwards. Like, nobody wanted to buy down there. So I was just essentially going to get my house seized and be forced to move. And I couldn't get hired for a job because I was an internet guy and the internet was bust. And I, at the time, this was, you know, almost 20 years ago, I was a failed investor, so no one was going to hire me for that. And I had no other skills. I couldn't go back to a job. I had two kids to raise. So I thought about killing myself for the life insurance policy because the kids were too young to remember me. Blah, blah, blah. I've told all this story before. So again, it's all relative. But I used to take these really long walks I felt good, and it got me out of the house, and it kind of got me out of my head a little bit. I would take these long walks, and I was walking past Chinatown, and there's this one little strip in the Bowery where you can buy restaurant supplies. And I don't know why, I walked into that store and I saw this box of waiter's pads, and I bought them. I just like the design of a waiter's pad too. They like look good to me. There's sort of this nostalgic 1950s or 1940s look to a waiter's pad. There's something about waiter's pads I like. Plus, I have a fetish about waitresses, so I wanted a waiter's pad. And then the next day, again, I have nothing going on. I had lost all my money. I was losing everything. So I would just wake up. I couldn't sleep ever, so I'd sleep 4 hours a night because I was depressed. And I would always go to a cafe, and I would take a nonfiction book to learn something, a fiction book to learn to write better, and a book about games, because I always loved any improving at any game. And I took this time a waiter's pad with me. And I started writing 10 ideas a day, and I'll describe the first list in a second. But after about 3 months, people don't realize, people are like, oh, ideas are a dime a dozen. I can come up with ideas anytime. Good ideas are really hard. And maybe a dime for a dozen ideas is true, but to come up with thousands of ideas so you can find maybe one or two good ones, that's much more than a dime. And plus, execution ideas are, people say execution is everything. You have to have ideas on how to execute, or else you'll execute poorly. So execution ideas are a subset of ideas. And so you have to be able to write down good execution ideas too. But I found after writing 10 ideas a day for 3, maybe 6 months, I was suddenly coming up with lots of good ideas. And this is a subject of a whole other podcast, like where it led me to. It changed my entire life once I started coming up with good ideas. But the first list I wrote was, I wanted to write a book, How to Beat Your Friends at Every Game in the Universe. Because I was thinking, a lot of times friends get together or families get together at Thanksgiving, and after the dinner, they break out board games. And at the time, board games were a recession-proof business category, like Monopoly or Scrabble or chess or checkers. Now, because of the internet, this doesn't work as much anymore. Everybody plays games on the internet, or there's more where kids play different games now. Like, I went into a game store the other day, and chess and checkers were in the nostalgic category as opposed to the real categories. So I bought Boggle in the for my kids in the nostalgic category. But anyway, the first list I made was the 10 chapters I would write. So it was like chess, checkers, Othello, poker, bridge, hearts, Monopoly, Scrabble, and backgammon, and a couple others. And then the next day was the execution ideas. Okay, how do you get better? What are 3 easy ways to get better at Scrabble so you could beat everybody else who doesn't know these 3 ways? So for instance, if you know the 96 two-letter words, if you know all the Q without U words, and if you know the four-letter words that start with J, you could be, even if those first 2 tips, you'll beat anyone who doesn't know that XI, XU, and QI, and ZA are words, you'll beat. Anyone who doesn't know that QAT, QOPF, QANAT is a word, you'll beat. That's all you need to know to win at Scrabble. So I came up with the ideas for each chapter, never wrote the book, because you don't have to. You don't have to follow up on any of these ideas. And again, within 3 to 6 months of just doing this, my ideas were so good at that point that I did start making money. I started 2 different careers, one as a hedge fund manager, the other as a professionally paid writer, just because of the ideas I was writing down in my waiter's pad, which is a whole different story of how I got to that point. But I wouldn't have been able to write those ideas on day one. It took me 6 months of every day writing down 10 ideas a day. But I will add, the one thing I never said about this was, once I started writing those 10 ideas a day, I got such confidence in myself that it literally saved me from depression. I came up with ideas on how to maybe sell my house rather than get it completely seized. And in fact, I took a huge loss, but I was able to sell the house. And just the confidence alone, I was still back and forth depressed, but writing the 10 ideas a day was almost like an antidepressant for me. And so, yeah,
It's very helpful. Yeah, it's great.
I mean, I could literally talk for an hour about all the lists I've made on the waiter's pad. Often I write posts based on the list of the day. I just wrote, my list today was 10 billion dollar business ideas. All of them probably bad ideas, but I'm going to write a post on it just to kind of show my process. And anyway, we're going to do part 2. Yeah. If anyone has questions about these life hacks or wants to throw out other ones, tweet me at Jay Altucher. Steve, you're not on Twitter yet.
I got to get into the 21st century.
Or follow me on Instagram. Yeah. I post a lot of my waiter's pad lists on Instagram. So follow me on Instagram at Altucher.
And
social media, I'm coming for you soon.
So Kamal thanks for being
Kamal, what's your handle?
Thanks for hanging out.
That was fun.
Beliana, thanks for visiting. And Jay, thanks for the audio engineering. And WeWork, again, they're not sponsoring this, right? They're not paying me to say this. This is a fucking amazing place. I'm looking out here. Everyone's like having a party and working at the same time.
By the way, next time we play Scrabble, Jay is a three-letter word that begins with Jay, right?
That's true. All right. Thanks a lot, Steve. We're going to do a part two on this.
Yeah,
and
thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
That's great.
Yeah. That was a great episode.
Okay, you know, by the way, you know how to win at... Do you play checkers?
Not since I was a kid.
Checkers is a great game, actually. People think checkers is like a dumb chess. It's actually a really hard game to play. But I'll just give you one piece of advice. Start with the corner where you have two corners on your back row. One has one of your checkers right in the corner. The other has no checkers in the corner, and you have the two checkers on the surrounding the corner. Start with the side that where you have the checker in the corner, and just, you know, move. I don't know how to describe this. Move from the diagonal, starting with that corner. Just move all your checkers aiming towards the other guy's corner, and that's a tip to win in checkers.
Okay.
Okay. And Monopoly. That one's so hard to explain why. I'll let me do a different one. Monopoly. Own the orange squares. So New York Ave, St. James
Park Place.
And that's the blue squares.
Okay.
Tennessee Avenue, St. James, and New York. And do whatever you can. Give up Park Place and Broadway, which are the blue squares. Give them up if you can get the orange squares. And I'll tell you why. Can you guess why?
No. The placement, or like how often people end up there?
Yes, how often people end up there,
The dice roll.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because what's the most common square that you're on in Monopoly, in a game of Monopoly? What square will you end up on the most in Monopoly? Okay, I'll tell you. You'll end up in jail because there's so many ways to end up on jail. You can either roll the dice, or there's two community chess cards that can get you to jail, or there's the go-to-jail square that also gets you to jail. So there's four or five different ways to end up in jail. Now, the most common dice roll is a 7. The 7 actually ends you up on a utility, but the utility is right in the middle of all the orange squares. So you're most likely, the property you're most likely to end up on in a game of Monopoly is the orange squares. So get the orange squares, build hotels there as fast as possible, and you'll clean up a Monopoly against your friends and family.